Welcome to Ghost in the Valley podcast. I'm your host, Al Cooley. Today I have Steve Deals. Steve is the director of Transcend Paranormal. It's a paranormal investigation group out of Hanover, Virginia. He's also the president of the board of directors for the Hanover Tavern Foundation. Steve has some great stories to share with me today. I'll be right back with those stories right after these brief messages.
Ghost stories are always scarier when they're told by the very people who experience them. Hi, I'm Becky.
And I'm Diana.
And we're the hosts of the Homespun Haints podcast.
We talk to people just like you who've come face to face with ghosts, demons, haints, and other strange paranormal phenomena. All of it makes for a chilling good time.
So grab yourself a sweet tea, turn off the lights, and listen to some eerie, true ghost stories on Homespun Haints, wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm not scared. Are you?
Today I have Steve Dills. He is the director of Transcend Paranormal and also the president board of directors for the Hanover Tavern Foundation. And you can go to transcendparanormal.com and also hanovertavern.org. And both those sites will be at the bottom of this episode. Welcome, Steve.
Hey, how's it going, Al?
Going great.
Fantastic.
Yeah, I see you're from Hanover, Virginia.
I am. That's where I live currently. I wasn't born here, but this is where I live right now.
Where were you born?
I was actually born in Jersey, so I'm a Jersey boy.
Oh, you're a Jersey boy. All right.
So I was born in Jersey, lived outside of Philadelphia for a little while, and then moved down here with my family when I was younger. But I am down here in Virginia, good old Virginia.
And I see on your Transcend Paranormal is a paranormal investigation team, right?
So Transcend Paranormal, we were kind of unofficially founded in 2007. And then officially, we kind of organized and founded our team in 2010. And so we're a paranormal team that's based out of Central Virginia. And what we do is we work with clients, whether it be at like their private home or their business, lots of different historical sites we work with. But we try to investigate claims of like paranormal phenomena and ongoings at that location. And then do whatever we need to fully kind of assist and help the client, whether it's, you know, figure out or, you know, how to live in that scenario or that situation, or identify what it is. You know, we just try to do what we can to help everybody.
I see you started out with four members. I was looking at your page today and I'm like, wow, you have what, how many, like nine members?
Today we have somewhere around 15.
Okay, you've added to it.
Yes.
That's quite impressive, you know, because, you know, sometimes all the members can't make one location or they're the ones, you know, more suited for another location. The history, I mean, I know you have to be intrigued with the history of like some of the buildings.
Yeah. And so kind of commenting on like, we do have a rather big team. A lot of the teams, especially in my area, but a lot of teams tend to be smaller, where you'll have anywhere between two to, you know, eight people, six people on a team. We are kind of built a little differently. And like you said, it is very rare that all of us are in the same place at the same time. A lot of us have different working schedules, you know, dynamic, you know, lives where we've got kids and families and, you know, maybe we're taking care of parents or, you know, pets or something like that. So one of the nice things is everybody on our team is very mature in the sense that if they can't make it to something, they understand that it's to help the client. And that's what we're there for. We're not there. I mean, yes, we have a lot of fun. It is a passion. It's a hobby, but it's to help whoever that person is. And so we don't really have a huge issue with like, you know, okay, well, we've got a residential case coming up and it's a rancher. You can't fit 15 people in a rancher. And so we'll, you know, what we'll do is we go out and we interview the client. We tour that location and we'll identify, okay, well, we only need, you know, three or four investigators. And then we work with what is the knowledge base and the skill set that each person on the team has, what best fits this client. And then we take it from there. So we kind of look at it from a different standpoint, as opposed to like everybody go out and let's cram as many people as we can into a location.
Yeah, I was looking on your website, some of the members, I don't know if they're still on your team or you've got new members. Evidently you have new members, but I'm was looking at some of their responses. I got almost all of them were the same. You know, the equipment they use, I liked the best was either audio or digital recorder. Mm-hmm. Would that be like a Spirit Box or EVPs?
It depends. And so we've changed that up slightly. The original ask kind of was like, I wanted to put faces to our team so that we're not just this organization that's out there that nobody knows who we are. I feel like it's a little bit more personal and familiar. And so I was like, hey, give me, you know, what's your current favorite piece of equipment? And that always changes. I mean, there's new equipment coming out. And I mean, that changes pretty significantly and pretty often. I will say that one of the most important tools that we use is audio and video recording. And that is so that we can document everything that's going on in the environment around us from a audible and visual perspective, right? I mean, there's environmental data. And like one of my favorite pieces of equipment now tends to be what's called an EDI Plus, which is a data logger. And I love that. I love doing data logging and looking at environmental data. And that's fairly new. So, you know, it changes a little bit. I mean, I still love, you know, one of my other favorites is my camera rig that I carry around, and it can film in zero lux, and it's great. And I've got a dead light, which is an infrared light that I've mounted to it, as well as a Zoom audio recorder and a shotgun mic. So I can pick up everything around me and everything directly in front of the camera. So it changes. But I mean, our big focus is trying to document what's going on, no matter what it is, trying to document it. And so like audio and video tends to be pretty important when you want to document, you know, the visual and audible environment around you.
You know, because people want it proof. You know, they want to see what might be haunting their house or business, you know. And nine times out of ten, I mean, for me, it always happened outside the camera or the equipment.
Yep. You know, so as soon as
turn the camera off or the Spirit Box off or whatever you're using, then everything starts up as soon as I turn it off. Now, sometimes these spirits don't know what that equipment is.
Sure. Definitely. Yes. I agree with that. The common, and we could sit here for hours on this and discuss. So, you know, be afraid of what I'm about to say, but, I've murdered my team's ears on the idea of what a ghost is, what mm-hmm. is a spirit. The most common and prevalent idea behind what is a spirit is it's somebody that's passed on, right? Somebody that has died, they have left their physical body. And so that energy, which can be neither created nor destroyed, has somehow transported out of the body. And you still have, you know, your personality and your being, your essence, right? Your spirit. And so if we take that idea just in and of itself, and we go and investigate a location, for whatever reason, this spirit is at this location, and it may not understand what some of that equipment is. For example, one of our favorite places to investigate is a place called Henricus Historical Park, and it's in Chester, Virginia. It is the second oldest English settlement in America. And so when we're there, we're interacting with spirits that are old. Like, I'm talking like 1620s. Right. Sometimes even before, because that is the very first place that we recorded a non-English EVP, which was actually Virginia Algonquin. To them, walking in with all of this equipment, I mean, you might as well be a witch, right? Mm-hmm. So 1620s, they're afraid of witchcraft and things that are not explainable to their current understanding of reality. And so if you have this silver tube, right, this cylinder, and when you press something on it, it shoots this light out one end of it. Is that harmful? Like, is that going to hurt me? And so why chance it? You know, just stay away from it. We've seen that. There are buildings there. When we go in and try to investigate, we get nothing until we put away all the equipment and we try to hide it. And we've actually done that, where a good friend of mine, John Sable, I love John, and he calls himself a ghost excavator. And so when he's investigating, he's excavating, and he looks at the paranormal almost like an onion, where you've got layers, right? Mm-hmm. And each layer you go back towards the core is an older part or time in history. And so when you're investigating, instead of whipping out all this equipment that nobody in that time period understands, and it might, you know, it's witchcraft, it's misunderstood, like, stop doing that. You know, if you're going to put out anything, hide it in that location and then come back 1 to 2 hours later so that it has been accepted as this is in that corner. It's not doing anything. It's not hurting me. It's in that corner. Then come back and investigate. But when you do so, one of the most amazing things is, have you ever heard of like trigger objects?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So instead of doing just a trigger object, like let's say we're focusing on the Civil War, right? 1860s. Instead of just bringing, let's say, a rifle or a musket, mm-hmm. dressing everyone up in attire that would have been from the 1860s. Not only that, but only using candles to see, maybe playing some music that would have been from that time period, maybe some smells, maybe have somebody cooking like some fried chicken or something that's just very basic and would have been served at that time period. And then using the dialect from that time, right?
Mm-hmm.
When, you know, when we swear and we curse and all this sort of stuff, that was not the same words from that time period, right?
Right.
You know, our language is always evolving. And so when we've done that, keep in mind, we've hidden our cameras and our audio recorders in corners of the room or over here under this thing so nobody can see it. We're getting lots of activity. I'm talking about like hearing people talking, hearing footsteps, watching a door close. Like, I mean, and this is all in one session, one-hour session, where these things would be like holy grail kind of activity, right?
You're right.
But we're getting all this in this one session. And I really think it has to do with the familiarity that you build and that trust that you instill. Like, I am comfortable in this situation because I understand what they're saying. I understand their language. Their clothing is familiar to me. And this is more appropriate for what I understand. I really think that is a big part of it.
Yeah, I agree. That makes a lot of sense. You know, I never really thought about that, because if you are talking in today's jargon, you know, and you got all your equipment out, they have no idea what these lights and grids and everything you're putting on the walls. And so it does make a lot of sense if you would go there in your Civil War attire.
Yeah.
Try to communicate on their level.
Yeah. I mean, you're essentially meeting. I mean, this is a big term that I in a lot of my leadership training that I've been doing, but meeting people where they are. You're doing the same thing. You're just meeting the spirit where they are from a comfort level. I mean, that would be the same with me, right? If I, you know, got on a plane and went to another country, the mannerisms and the culture there is going to be completely different than what it is where I understand it here in America. Different language, different way people dress, how they talk. Everything's going to be different, including, you know, even the most basic things like history. You know, just like, I'm not going to ask about the Civil War in America if I'm over investigating, you know, let's say in India or something.
Uh-huh.
So I think it really depends on understanding the historical context of that location and then using it to your benefit when you're investigating.
It's always good to know the history of that location also.
Mm-hmm. I think it's incredibly important.
I think you'll have a better outcome if you respect the building and the people you're investigating.
Oh, 100%. I've seen so many teams that will just go into a location and they don't know what's going on there historically, what happened, and the stories that come out of that where it's just very clearly like nobody understands what's going on. It's just, I feel like it's a shame. One thing that my team does is we spend a lot of time leading up to an investigation, understanding the history of that location, because that directly correlates to the questions that we're going to ask, the way that we're going to ask them, the equipment that we're going to be using. All these things really, you know, play a very important part in investigating. I mean, you can go into some locations and use all your equipment because it's not that old and it's not going to be very foreign. For example, there is a place called St. Albans Sanatorium here in Virginia. Mm-hmm. And it's an old insane asylum. Before that, it was a boys' school. Lots of activity, and you can use your equipment in there, but it also didn't shut down like in the 1800s or anything, you know? Like, it was active when they had equipment. I mean, they were treating people with equipment. And mm-hmm. so something like a flashlight or an audio recorder, granted, it's much smaller than it was then, but still, like, it still applies. It's still applicable. So I feel like, you know, there you can break out all this stuff. Granted, I feel like a laser grid is still weird to anybody that doesn't investigate. They're not going to know what the heck a laser grid is. Mm-hmm. But you know, the rest of it, you know, it's great.
If they want to communicate with you, that's the key, you know, and I found they pick who they want to communicate with a lot of times. And
I agree.
You said you started in 2007. Mm-hmm. What got you into the paranormal?
So I actually got pretty interested in the paranormal young. When we moved down to Virginia from Pennsylvania, my dad had a job opportunity for a very small, very not well-known company, Pfizer. He had the opportunity to take on the head of R&D down here. And so that was great and everything, but the catch was we had to move quick. So that he could get down here and start working. So my parents grabbed really one of the first houses they could find so that he could get down here and start working. And in the meantime, we would start building a house. We moved into a home and immediately they started looking for property to build. So we were only there for 2 years. And as my mother puts it, 2 years too long. As soon as we moved into the house, granted, keep in mind, I was younger. I was probably in fourth grade. But I got sick, like really sick. And so I was out of school for some time, would go to the doctors. They wouldn't understand what was going on with me. You know, by all measures, I was perfectly healthy. And then the room that I was staying in, my bedroom, changed. By that, I mean, I would be sleeping or I would be trying to sleep and be late at night. And I would watch my bedroom door and my closet doors open and close by themselves. I would hear my name whispered at night. I would hear my name screamed into my ear at night, waking me up. And I would often hear a piano playing late in the evenings. And, you know, we did have a piano in the house, but it was not played all that often. And it definitely wasn't being played, you know, past midnight. It kind of culminated in two different ways. The first is I started seeing doppelgangers of my dog. And so I recall very vividly being outside playing in my front yard. And this was in a neighborhood. All right. So this is not like out in the middle of the woods or anything. This is in a neighborhood, a well-known neighborhood in the area. Around the side of my house, my dog walks into the front yard. That's pretty odd. I'm like, we're in a neighborhood. There's a lot of cars through here. So I'm like, all right, you got to get inside, boy. Like, it's time to go. You got to get inside so you don't get hit. So I start, you know, kind of like trying to yell at him to go back inside. He ends up going around the other side of the house towards the garage. And so I assume that he goes into the garage and inside. But I was like, well, let me make sure because maybe the garage door is not open, you know, or whatever. So I follow him around and he's gone, completely gone. I look around the backyard. I don't see him. I go inside, not in the basement. I go up the steps and he's sitting on the couch with his head in my mother's lap asleep. And I'm like, okay, well, I'm glad he got in. I said, I'm surprised he fell asleep so quick, Mom. And she's like, he's been sitting here on my lap for like an hour now. I'm just watching TV. That was like the first time. And then I would start seeing him all over, like in the basement when I'm sitting down there by myself. And I'd see him come down the steps and, you know, walk up behind me. And then I'd turn around and he's gone. I mean, it would happen all the time. And I always thought that was quite odd. The second thing that happened that really set me off was I was actually taking a shower in my parents' bathroom because they had the nice shower. And so they had one of these fogged glass pane showers, like a stand-up shower, right? Uh-huh. So I'm in there showering. And the next thing I look out the door and there is this red orb like hovering in the room. So I open the door because I'm like, what's that? So opening it. And it's like a baseball-sized red orb floating in the middle of the room. And of course, young me is scared. And so I start screaming. As soon as my parents bust in to the master bedroom, this thing floats out of the bedroom and takes a right-hand turn right into their walk-in closet. So they come in. They're like, what's wrong? What's wrong? What's wrong? And I'm like, I just saw something. It's in the closet. And my dad's like, I'm going to go into the closet and look. And I'm like, no, no, no. So he goes into the closet. Of course, he doesn't find anything. But I mean, that scared me to death.
I mean, you said your mother, she said it was 2 years too long. Mm-hmm. Evidently, she's witnessed some stuff too then.
Yes. Yep. She what we called the lady in gray. She would see this woman in a gray hoop skirt, very reminiscent of like Civil War, like right after, maybe a little bit into the Victorian era. And she would always see her back turned to her, but she would always see her roaming through the home. She would knock things over. And we had a number of incidents where like every female family member, including my aunts and my grandmother that would come over, would all witness her. None of the men. I never saw her. My father never saw her. My grandfather never saw her. My uncles never saw her. Nobody, not a single man saw this woman. And she would roam through the house. And we had this rocking chair that was in the attic. It was a walk-up attic, so you could easily get it. You know, it wasn't like a drop-down, like an access panel or anything. You could actually open up a door and walk up to the attic. So they stored a bunch of, you know, junk as attics go. And this rocking chair was up there. And so for whatever reason, she loved that rocking chair. And it would sit in a corner. We'd go out for the day or something. You'd come back home and that rocking chair is sitting in one of the windows facing the front of the home, like out into our front yard. You'd see the rocking chair in the window rocking. And so you'd go up there, you'd put the rocking chair back into the corner where it was. And that would happen countless times. We'd come back from vacation. We'd come back, you know, from going out to dinner or whatever. And this rocking chair would be in that window rocking.
Wow.
You know, the lights in the attic would turn on and off by themselves. So much that we'd get phone calls from the neighbors asking why we're having a strobe light party in the attic. I mean, it was wild. And so I was pretty scared, right? And it didn't stop until we moved out. And that was at the 2-year mark. And so when we moved out, none of that activity came with us. And it was pretty detrimental to me. Like there were a lot of really serious, nasty things that were going on. And so that always kind of stuck with me. And so as I grew up and finally got my own car and then moved out, that's just something that I inevitably wanted to explore. And so I started investigating and then I realized that like, hey, maybe I can use my own experiences and battle scars to help other people so that they don't feel like this singled out individual in their own home that should be a comfortable location, a place that you want to go home from the refuge, you know, a refuge from the world at the end of the day. But instead, you are scared to heck to go home. And I don't feel like anybody should ever feel that way. And so that's why we formed the team to try to like help people.
Mm-hmm. Where was that house located? Was that in Virginia?
Mm-hmm. It's in Hanover County. I don't want to call anybody out because people still live there.
Yeah, you said when you were saying where you were, yeah, you're born in the New Jersey. So I was just curious if the house was in New Jersey or was it in Virginia?
It's in Virginia. And I'm pretty sure it's tied to like Civil War.
Because Virginia has a lot of activity.
Yeah, it does. It does. And I mean, when I went back and started researching that part of the land, there wasn't necessarily a battle or a skirmish there, but there was troop movement through that area. So I really believe that it was probably tied to the Civil War, like the grounds, not the home, because it was actually a newly built house. Nobody had lived in it before us.
Is Hanover, Virginia near Gettysburg?
We're not terribly far from Gettysburg, a couple hour drive, but Hanover saw a lot of activity during the Civil War. And then even, you know, prior to that, into the Revolution, the American Revolution. I mean, for example, one of the places that we investigate, my team investigates, is the historic courthouse here in Hanover County. It's the third oldest operating courthouses in America. And that's the location that Patrick Henry gave his impassioned Parsons Cause argument, which was one of the sparks of the American Revolution. So not only do we have like Civil War history here, but we've got the whole, you know, the whole run of it of history in America. There is a lot of stuff that goes on in Hanover County.
I'll be right back with the rest of my conversation with Steve Dills after these brief messages.
Let's talk about it.
The Mother-Daughter-ish podcast and YouTube TV show is all about the conversations that mothers and daughters have, the conversations they don't like to have, and the conversations that just have to be discussed. Join us on all podcasting platforms. Watch our show on YouTube. Hey, guess what? It's your mama's favorite podcast and the podcast your daughter is so glad she found. Check out the Mother-Daughter-ish podcast and YouTube TV show.
When you were talking about that house, for 2 years.
It's an interesting childhood.
Right. In your investigations that you go on, have you ever had any physical contact?
We've definitely seen it. I mean, even in that particular house, I had my aunts were actually pushed, you know, while there. But there have been a few cases where we've been investigating, even historical locations that we work with. And that's another big thing that we do is we partner with historical locations to help them fundraise. But the very first thing that we do before we say, hey, we're going to do a public, you know, we'd like to do a public investigation here to help you raise money. We always like to privately go in and investigate the location first. And that gives us a good understanding of the location, the activity that's there, what we're going to be encountering. And at one of those sites, the very first time we were there, one of the gentlemen that was one of the docents, he brought his grandson along on the investigation. And so we're investigating. Everything's going great. And we go up to the attic of this location. And the next thing I know, he's coming, the grandson's coming downstairs because not only does he have a scratch mark running up his arm, but he also has bite marks. And so, you know, we took pictures of that and documented it and everything. But the interesting thing is, I mean, I even asked him, like, all right, show me, bite your arm, like you bite your own arm. The location that the bite mark was at was physically impossible for him to actually do it. And furthermore, it was actually a much smaller jawline than he had, which indicated that it was more than likely some sort of child. That evening, I had another one of my investigators, actually, same thing. He was scratched while investigating. And actually, this was another building. It wasn't the same building, but it was all on the same property. And it's not a very big property. I mean, I'm talking about a house. And then off to the side, there was like a little gift shop. You know, that was a pretty interesting thing. The thing that I always keep in mind with that is it was the very first time anybody had ever investigated that location. I feel like it's almost very similar to like you have been at your home. I mean, the pandemic is great. The pandemic is a perfect example. You know, everybody's been at home sitting in their own residences, right? And then all of a sudden, you have like 10 mm-hmm. people walk in and sit down in your living room. Either, you know, you're going to be scared to death that there are 10 people that you don't know that have all sat down in your living room, or you're going to be really upset. And so I kind of feel like it's the same thing where it's like, you know, when we go into these locations, first off, these are folks that haven't been talked to or interacted with for a long time. And now all of a sudden you're like, hey, I'm trying to talk to you. I want to say, you know, I want to hear about you. And so at first they're like, wait, me? Like, what's going on? They want to talk to me. And so the first time or two, they might be a little uncomfortable. Maybe they kind of forgot like how to interact, right? And in this case, I think it was a child that just didn't know any better. And he's like, hey, somebody's here to play with me. Mm-hmm. But I mean, after that, I went back a couple days later. I went to those locations where we had that activity. I said, hey, listen, you know, we're going to be here pretty often, but we need to set some ground rules here. Like, you cannot bite anybody. You can't scratch anybody. That is not how to communicate. Like, let's talk, you know, let's talk together, but we don't need to do that. And we've never had that happen since. I feel like it's a respectful thing, you know?
My thinking is, you know, an angry ghost is a whole lot different than a demon. So you can have an angry ghost and people get scared because of the mm-hmm. activity they do, you know? And like you said, you know, once you can communicate, you know, in a manner to calm them down. Yeah. So I think a lot of people, when I get called, okay, there's a demon in the house, you know, you know, it's not evil. It's just an angry spirit.
Okay. So I have a saying, because everybody, you know, there are a number of TV shows that like to, you know, push the idea that there's demons everywhere, which is very, very incorrect. But I'm a firm believer of asshole in life, asshole in death. And so just because you run into something that's angry doesn't mean that they're demonic, because if that was the case, then there are so many humans that I know that are demonic. you know what I mean? exactly. And I hate to imagine that I'm just living with a bunch of demons. So, you know, I mean,
that's a good way of putting that.
People that are mean in life, they may not. I mean, I don't know. I would assume that there is some capacity for learning and growth in the afterlife. I feel like it's got to be somewhat similar to us, where you still have the capacity to learn and grow and change slightly. But, you know, if you've got one of those strong personalities where you are just a butt, there's a good chance that you're still going to be a butt even after you've died. You know, we've run into a bunch of that where it's just somebody that's just really mean. And maybe it's because of the way that you're dressed or the way that you're acting or the way that you're talking. Maybe they just flat out don't like you. I mean, the activity that I get is always different than the activity that some of the females on my team get. So, you know, I don't know if that's my personality or what exactly that is, but I don't necessarily think that, you know, because you interact with something negative, that immediately means that it's demonic. Like, that just makes no sense to me. Like, there are really mean people, or maybe they're having a bad hair day. You know, I mean, you don't know. So to just immediately jump to the conclusion, like, oh, there's something demonic. Like, well, it scratched me, therefore it's demonic. I'm like, no. My seventh month old, when I pick him up, he scratches me. And that's just because he's got nails and doesn't know any better. It's one of those deals. I can't stand when people think like immediately everything's demonic. It's not.
Ever come across anything that was demonic?
I want to say that we've probably seen that two times with a possible third. And those times that has kind of set a precedence for our team in the way that we interact with cases and the way that we operate them. In IT, there's a term known as least privilege, where it's like, what is the least amount of things or rights or whatever to get the job done. And so we kind of operate with that until we know a little bit about a location. For example, we had a case that was potentially demonic in nature a couple years back. And one of the big things that we did was we took, like I said, you know, earlier, we kind of take a look at the team. Who do we need on this case and who wants to be on this case? It's not one of these deals where it's like, okay, everybody, let's pile in a car. Let's go see some demon stuff. You know, that sort of stuff can really affect you, and not just you, but your family and those around you. It can affect, you know, just tons of different aspects of your life. And so we're very careful and very specific in the way that we interact and the way that we go about trying to help in that instance. It's so rare.
Yeah, it is rare. And my wife says, you know, don't bring that
stuff. Same with my
home,
wife.
You know?
But that's a good point you bring up, though. Our objective going into that case was not to interact. Let's say it was a demonic entity. You should not interact. It's all about documenting. And so our goal was going in there with the people that we needed to help, documenting it, and then taking it to the church. And we already had a church lined up. We already had that, you know, we had everything we needed so that we could go in there. Because, you know, as you know, you can't just say, hey, I think it's a demon. Come on in. Like, there is a lot of red tape to pass through so that the church will come in and help these folks. You've got to prove it. And so that was our goal, is get in there, do what we need to do. If it is demonic, get it to the church immediately, because we don't need to be here.
Do you believe you can move a spirit on?
I don't know that I myself can.
So you want to make sure it's okay to move them on to leave.
Yes. And we've done that. You know, I think it's a matter of, you know, depending on, I fully believe on, like, if you haven't processed that you've died or you understand or know that you've died, I feel like you're in a different place of just confusion, right? But I also feel like there are some that flat out, I mean, so there is one location that we investigated quite a bit. And then the government there, the local government, decided that they didn't want the property, that building anymore. And so they put it up that, either anybody that wants it can take it and move it on your own dime, or we're going to demolish it in, you know, a couple weeks. And so one of the first things that we did is we went in there and we notified it. We said, hey, listen, everybody, you know, because it was a very active home. And we're like, you all need to understand what's going to happen. Like, it's not going to be nice, but this is what's going to happen is, in a couple weeks' time, because nobody had the money to move this home. I mean, it was an old pre-Civil War house. It was awesome, but it needed a serious amount of dough to move it, especially to move it within a couple weeks, you know? So we're like prepping, like, this is going to be destroyed. And when we went and, you know, we tried to do a cleansing of the home, and I believe that we got a lot of spirits that decided that they were going to move on. I think it needs to be a mutual thing. Like, hey, I understand and I'm ready to roll. There was one spirit that I know did not. And what happened was, when the home, right before it was demolished, one of the historical societies in the area went in and they rescued some of the original pieces of the home. So they went in and they took some of the windows, the original windows, the original balusters, and just different pieces and parts that were actual, you know, pre-Civil War pieces of this building, and they brought it back to their building. We also investigate that building. And wouldn't you know it, mm-hmm. this same ornery guy that we used to interact with in that home, we are now picking up in their building. You know, it lined up perfectly to when they went in and they got some of this, the original structure, and rescued it and brought it back to their building. Now we're getting him. And so I believe, you know, have we done it? Probably. It's one of those things where it's hard for me to say like 100% yes, I did it, because I don't know. Like, I don't have like a, you know, any data that says, okay, there were 10 spirits, now there's only 9. I think we did it, but I know that this person in particular decided that that's not what he wanted to do. And so when we've, you know, he was very angry when we were interacting with him at this home, the same activity, the same things, the same voice of this older male, we're getting in this other building now.
Well, you know, you're talking about, you know, the bad spirit, you know, the angry spirit. I was thinking, you know, these angry spirits, sometimes they don't move on because they're kind of stuck in limbo, whether they're going to go to heaven or to hell. And most likely they're going to go to hell because mm-hmm. it could be in hiding or.
Yeah, it could just be quiet. I mean, and that's honestly one of the really neat parts about this, right, is that uncertainty. You know, and on the flip side, I've been to locations like St. Albans, for example. It is one of the most active locations I investigate. I mean, seeing visible things, hearing footsteps, hearing and watching doors open and close, the whole nine yards. But I've also been there where there was absolutely no activity, and it was a very quiet night, and we didn't get anything. Now, that's not to say that, you know, it's not an active or a haunted location, but I feel like it's one of those things like the weather where sometimes it's raining and sometimes it's sunny. So, you know, just because I didn't experience anything on one night doesn't mean there isn't paranormal activity there. It just means for whatever reason, I didn't experience it on that evening. Now, I'd go back the next night and it's just crazy, you know, or maybe 1 hour there's nothing going on and the next hour it's off the wall. Uh-huh. So it's hard to say. I mean, I don't know what that equation, like why that is. I know there's a few theories out there. One of the ones that some friends of mine are looking into is the idea behind the electromagnetic field that the Earth itself puts off and how it ebbs and flows. And their data is correlating towards the idea that when the local EMF field that is being generated by the planet, that will spike. And then as it's coming down from that spike, you see a lot of activity. When it hits the bottom, there's nothing. When it's building, not a whole lot of activity. But as soon as you're in that downslope coming off of that spike, that ebb and flow, then you see activity. But that changes. So some days you are just consistently in a downward slope, or some days it's, you know, up and down and up and down and up and down. There's, you know, not a whole lot of consistency to it.
Also been brought to my attention that, you know, these sightings have been escalating, you know, in the past year of ghosts, spirits, UFOs, because people have been home quarantined. Mm-hmm. You know, they haven't been home all the time. Now you're home 24/7,
you know, experiencing your own environment,
right? And like you say, once you go first and you want to debunk whatever is there to begin with, you know, there's no spirit mm-hmm. there, because it could be something outside of the paranormal. You just can't explain. Well, that's what the paranormal is, you know. You can't explain these activities, but you can try to communicate with what's there.
And the interesting thing about it is, I mean, a lot of these folks that are explaining or that are claiming that there's all of a sudden there's activity in their homes that they weren't recognizing before, you know, keep in mind, I mean, the typical American tends to spend more time at their place of business than they do at home. And when they come mm-hmm. home, they've got set tasks. You know, if you've got kids, then it's get dinner on the table, get them bathed, get them in bed, and then you go to bed. If it's, you know, mm-hmm. and so like you, I've found, and I've been at the Hanover Tavern doing all the work that I do there from a historic perspective. When I go in there with a mission, like I've got to do these sets of things, these sets of tasks, I don't experience a whole lot of activity unless it's right in my face. There could be things going on all around me, but I'm like, all right, I got to do this. I got to do that. I got to do this. I got to do that. And then I get out of here. It's the same thing when you come home, right? You're like, all right, I got to get the dishes washed. Mm-hmm. I got to pack my lunch for tomorrow. I've got to do the laundry. I've got to get the kids bathed. I got to get to, you know, I got to get to bed. And then you spend a lot of time sleeping. You wake up in the morning and you start your routine again. So a lot of these folks that have been home during the pandemic are spending more time in their environment that previously they really didn't get to, right? And so now they're noticing these things because they actually have the ability to.
And how far out do you go to investigate?
It depends. I mean, the farthest I have gone to date is up to Massachusetts. But I mean, we've been, I don't know, I guess, I don't know if Florida's even further or not, but we've been up and down the East Coast. You know, typically those are kind of the rare things. Everything that we do as a team is nonprofit. It all, you know, whatever location we're going to, if it's to assist a location, everything's free. So it's our own money put into hotels, traveling, eating, you know, everything that we need to take care of ourselves comes out of our pockets. So, you know, if we're assisting folks, we try to keep it, you know, mostly within a 1 to 2, maybe 3 hour travel distance. But, you know, depending, I mean, we've driven 7-8 hours to go and host like a public paranormal investigation. Again, that's all travel money out of our own pockets, hotels out of our own pockets. Then we get to help these historical sites fundraise for their continued restoration and preservation. So to me, that's a huge thing, is being able to give back and helping these locations, because without these historical sites, we are going to be investigating in fields.
What do you have coming up?
We have a lot coming up. October is always the month for all of the things. The first thing that we have coming up is October 15th and 16th. And we're going to be at a place called Fleetwood Church. It's an old, almost Civil War church that sits in Brandy Station, Virginia, which is the site of the largest cavalry battle of the Civil War. And we're going to be investigating with a bunch of other different teams, including our good friend Spirit Guides Paranormal. That same Saturday, we're actually going to be at a place called Scotchtown, which is where Patrick Henry and his wife, Sarah Shelton, and their children lived for a number of years. And we're going to be doing a ghost tour there. Then October 24th, 25th, and 26th, we're going to be at the Hanover Tavern for Ghosts Walk at Night, which is a ghost tour of the tavern. October 29th and 30th, we're going to be at Henricus Historical Park. And then on the 30th, we're actually going to be doing an overnight investigation into Halloween, which is going to be a lot of fun.
Wow.
And then November 6th, we haven't announced it yet, but November 6th, we are going to be doing a new public investigation. And we're going to be combining, these are all Civil War locations, but we're going to be combining a place called the Beaver Dam Depot, North Anna Battlefield, and the Hanover Tavern. That is going to be new. So that's going to wrap up our October season. And then looking at next year, we're actually going to be kicking it off with the very first Paracon that we're going to be hosting at the Hanover Tavern. And that's going to be on January 21st and 22nd. So I'm really excited about that one. We've been talking about doing like a big conference for a number of years, and finally the stars have aligned. So
where can people contact you or get a hold of you or find out about your team?
So we are online at transcendparanormal.com. We post the vast majority of our things on social media. So you can find us on Facebook at Transcend Paranormal. Same with Instagram, Twitter. And that is the best way to contact us. We've got an email, transcendparanormal@gmail.com. But again, if you send it through the Facebook, there's a few of us that actually have access to that, and we'll see it and respond. So that's the best way to get to us.
Awesome. Before I get off here, I do want to give a plug to the Hanover Tavern. I was checking that out today. My God, I got to visit that place.
Yeah, come on down.
I do want to make it there, but I was checking out the that Brunswick stew, man.
I had some for dinner last night. It was awesome.
The Martha Ann Field story, I mean, the plays that you put on there also is interesting.
The tavern, the Hanover Tavern, is one of the oldest continuous operating taverns in America. The original tavern on the property dates back to 1733. So our current building, the Hanover Tavern that stands today, we call the quote-unquote new tavern. And the earliest portion of the building today that is standing is from 1791. And then we had an addition in 1821, 1831 to combine the two buildings into what it is today, one big building. And then in the 1990s, when the Hanover Tavern Foundation purchased the building, we added an additional wing that houses all of our electricity, you know, electrical, as well as some bathrooms, some storage space, and all that sort of stuff. It's an amazing building.
Does the building have activity in it? Is that why you're doing an investigation?
Yeah, there's a lot of activity there in terms of the paranormal. It is such an amazing building. You know, old homes are money pits. In the 1990s, when we first purchased the building, it cost somewhere around $5 million just to make it safe enough for people to be able to walk in. So it took quite a bit of money. And then, you know, every year it takes money just to keep the building together and make sure that everything is operating smoothly, replacing some of the electricity and, you know, the electric components and everything. But yeah, I mean, it's a great spot. We had the very first dining theater in America in the tavern, and they still perform there to this day. We've had Patrick Henry, George Washington, Rochambeau, Marquis de Lafayette, P.T. Barnum stayed the night there once. Edgar Allan Poe would have been by the tavern numerous times. I mean, George Washington wrote about the tavern in his diary. So that's how, you know, prominent it was that he actually wrote about this inn that he stayed at. So it's a great spot. There is a lot of history. So we know about two really cool folks that were there. The first is Margaret White, who was a refugee during the Civil War. And she actually stayed at the tavern for a period of time because she, you know, her home was taken over. And so she wrote a diary while she was there to pay their rent for staying there. She ended up making envelopes that she would sell to soldiers as they passed by. And the tavern actually served as a post office during the Civil War. So if you think the post service today is pretty slow, tavern was probably slow.
Right.
The postal service is like, well, what's central to everything? Taverns. All right. We're dropping the mail off at the taverns. Folks, you need to come get your mail. It is a pipe dream that at one point we can get a separate building to place our offices so that we can turn it into a like an inn again, like a proper tavern. But today you can't sleep in the building overnight. But I mean, it's great. So we've got Margaret White. Martha Ann Fields, who you touched on, was actually an enslaved cook that lived on a plantation across the street. And the owner of that plantation owned the Hanover Tavern for a period of time. So not only was she cooking for this plantation, but she was cooking for the tavern. And she has a remarkable story about how she escaped slavery and ended up in Hampton. And all of her family came together under one roof, which was very unheard of. And I'm talking like 8 children and her husband. 3 of her children had been sold to other plantations, and her husband had been sold to another plantation. And so she was able to reconnect her entire family under one roof, which is phenomenal. 2 of her sons went on to be lawyers. They practiced law, and they were very successful. So it is a great, it's awesome that we were able to know that history and share it.
Will that play be coming back again? Or
yep, the woman that portrays Margaret White, Val Davis, she's in the area, and we try to host it, you know, once a year, depending on her schedule. Really, it's really up to her schedule, but we always like to get her on stage. It's amazing. I mean, you will sit in there. This sounds horrible, but you'll sit in there and bawl. I mean, she is the mm-hmm. story is so passionate and just, you know, breathtaking. It is phenomenal, and she does such a great job telling that story and sharing it with people. And I think it's a very important story for people to hear.
Well, it's been my pleasure having you on the show tonight. Great stories, and gonna have to have you back next year.
Yeah, certainly. Thank you for having me tonight. I appreciate it very much.
I want to thank Steve Dills from the Transcend Paranormal. Please check out his links at the bottom of this podcast, and if you can, make it to Hanover, Virginia, and check out the Hanover Tavern. You won't be disappointed. I'm your host, Al Cooley. I'll see you in 2 weeks with another great episode on Ghosts in the Valley.